What are you going to do? She asked. When this is all over. I don't know, he said. The question had been in the back of his mind ever since she told him about the house. The house itself sat there in his imagination, sometimes benign, sometimes threatening, like a trick picture that changed depending on how you tilted it against the light. Sometimes it sat there in the glow of the sun, comfortable, low, and spreading, surrounded by its amiable jungle of a yard, and it looked like home. Other times it looked like a gigantic millstone, requiring him to run and run and run just to stay level with the starting line. He knew people with houses. He had talked to them with the same kind of detached interest he would talk to a person who kept snakes as pets or entered ballroom dancing competitions. Houses forced you into a certain lifestyle. Even if somebody gave you one for nothing, like Leon had, it committed you to a whole lot of different things. There were property taxes, he knew that. There was insurance in case the place burned down or was blown away in a high wind. There was maintenance. People he knew with houses were always doing something to them. They would be replacing the heating system at the start of the winter because it had failed, or the basement would be leaking water, and complicated things with excavations would be required. Roofs were a problem, he knew that, people had told him. Roofs had a finite lifespan, which surprised him. The shingles needed stripping off and replacing with new. Siding also. Windows, too. He had known people who had put new windows in their houses. They had deliberated long and hard about what type to buy. Are you going to get a job? Jody asked. He stared out through the oval window at Southern California, dry and brown, 7 miles below him. What sort of a job? The house was going to cost him maybe $10,000 a year in taxes and premiums and maintenance. And it was an isolated house, so he would have to keep Rudder's car, too. It was a free car, like the house, but it would cost him money just to own. Insurance, oil changes, inspection, title, gasoline. Maybe another $3,000 a year. Food and clothes and utilities were on top of all that. And if he had a house, he would want other things. He would want a stereo. He would want Winona Judd's record. And a whole lot of others, too. He thought back to old Mrs. Hobie's handwritten calculations. She had settled on a certain sum of money she needed every year, and he couldn't see getting it any lower than she had got it. The whole deal added up to maybe $30,000 a year, which meant earning maybe $50,000 to take account of income taxes and the cost of 5 days a week traveling back and forth to wherever the hell he was going to earn it. I don't know, he said again. Plenty of things you could do. Like what? You've got talents. You're a hell of an investigator, for instance. Dad always used to say you're the best he ever saw. That was in the army, he said. That's all over now. Skills are portable, Reacher. There's always demand for the best. Then she looked up, a big idea in her face. You could take over Costello's business. He's going to leave a void. We used him all the time. That's great. First I get the guy killed, then I steal his business. It wasn't your fault, she said. You should think about it. So he looked back down at California and thought about it. Thought about Costello's well-worn leather chair and his aging, comfortable body. Thought about sitting in his pastel room with its pebble glass windows, spending his whole life on the telephone. Thought about the cost of running the Greenwich Avenue office, and hiring a secretary, and providing her with new computers, and telephone consoles, and health insurance, and paid vacations, all on top of running the garrison place. He would be working 10 months of the year before he got ahead by a single dollar. I don't know, he said again. I'm not sure I want to think about it. You're going to have to, maybe, he said, but not necessarily right now. She smiled like she understood, and they lapsed back into silence. The plane hissed onward, and the stewardess came back with the drinks cart. Jody got a refill of champagne, and Reacher took a can of beer. He flipped through the airline magazine. It was full of bland articles about nothing much in particular. There were advertisements for financial services and small, complicated gadgets, all of which were black and ran on batteries. He arrived at the section where the airline's operational fleet was pictured in little colored drawings. He found the plane they were on and read about its passenger capacity and its range and the power of its engines. Then he arrived at the crossword in the back. It filled a page and looked pretty hard. Jody was already there in her own copy ahead of him. "Look at 11 down," she said. He looked. "They can weigh heavy," he read. 16 letters. "Responsibilities," she said. Marilyn and Chester Stone were huddled together on the left-hand sofa in front of the desk because Hobie was in the bathroom alone with the two cops. The thick-set man in the dark suit sat on the opposite sofa with the shotgun resting in his lap. Tony was sprawled out next to him with his feet on the coffee table. Chester was inert, just staring into the gloom. Marilyn was cold and hungry and terrified. Her eyes were darting all around the room. There was total silence from the bathroom.
"What's he doing in there with them?" she whispered.
Tony shrugged.
"Probably just talking to them right now."
"About what?"
"Well, asking them questions about what they like and what they don't. In terms of physical pain, you understand? He likes to do that."
"God, why?"
Tony smiled. "He feels it's more democratic, you know, letting the victims decide their own fate."
Marilyn shuddered.
"Oh, God, can't he just let them go? They thought Cheryl was a battered wife, that's all. They didn't know anything about him."
"Well, they'll know something about him soon," Tony said. "He makes them pick a number. They never know whether to pick high or low because they don't know what it's for. They think it might please him, you know, if they pick right. They spend forever trying to figure it out."
"Can't he just let them go?
Maybe later?" Tony shook his head. "No," he said. "He's very tense right now. This will relax him. Like therapy."
Marilyn was silent for a long moment, but then she had to ask.
"What is the number for?"
she whispered.
"How many hours it takes them to die," Tony said. "The ones who pick high get real pissed when they find out."
"You bastards."
"Some guy once picked 100, but we let him off with 10.
"You bastards."
"But he won't make you pick a number. He's got other plans for you."
Total silence from the bathroom.
"He's insane,"
Marilyn whispered. Tony shrugged.
"A little, maybe. But I like him. He's had a lot of pain in his life. I think that's why he's so interested in it."
Marilyn stared on at him in horror. Then the buzzer sounded at the oak door out to the elevator lobby, very loud in the awful silence. Tony and the thick-set man with the shotgun spun around and stared in that direction.
"Check it out," Tony said.
He went into his jacket and came out with his gun. He held it steady on Chester and Marilyn. His partner with the shotgun jacked himself up out of the low sofa and stepped around the table to the door. He closed it behind him and the office went quiet again. Tony stood up and walked to the bathroom door, knocked on it with the butt of his gun, and opened it a fraction and ducked his head inside.
"Visitors," he whispered.
Marilyn glanced left and right. Tony was 20 feet from her, and he was the nearest. She jumped to her feet and snatched a deep breath, hurdled the coffee table and scrambled around the opposite sofa and made it all the way to the office door. She wrenched it open. The thick-set man in the dark suit was on the far side of the reception area talking to a short man framed in the doorway out to the elevator lobby.
"Help us!"
she screamed to him. The man stared over at her. He was dressed in dark blue pants and a blue shirt, with a short jacket open over it, the same blue as the pants, some kind of uniform. There was a small design on the jacket, left side of the chest. He was carrying a brown grocery sack cradled in his arms.
"Help us!"
she screamed again. Two things happened.
The thick-set man in the dark suit darted forward and bundled the visitor all the way inside and slammed the door after him, and Tony grabbed Marilyn from behind with a strong arm around her waist. He dragged her backward into the office. She arched forward against the pressure of his arms. She was bending herself double and fighting.
"God's sake, help us!"
Tony lifted her off her feet. His arm was bunching under her breasts. The short dress was riding up over her thighs. She was kicking and struggling. The short man in the blue uniform was staring. Her shoes came off, then the short man was smiling. He walked forward into the office after her, stepping carefully over her abandoned shoes, carrying his grocery sack.
"Hey, I'd like to get me a piece of that," he said. "Forget it," Tony gasped from behind her. "This one's off limits, time being."
"Pity,"
the new guy said. "Not every day you see a thing like that."
Tony struggled with her all the way back to the sofa, dumped her down next to Chester. The new guy shrugged wistfully and emptied the grocery sack on the desk. Bricks of cash money thumped out on the wood. The bathroom door opened and Hobie stepped into the room. His jacket was off and his shirt sleeves were rolled up to the elbow. On the left was a forearm. It was knotted with muscle and thick with dark hair. On the right was a heavy leather cup, dark brown, worn and shiny, with straps riveted to it running away up into the shirt sleeve. The bottom of the cup was narrowed to a neck, with the bright steel hook coming down out of it, running straight for 6 or 8 inches, and then curving around to the point.
"Count the money, Tony,"
Hobie said. Marilyn jerked upright, turned to face the new guy.
"He's got 2 cops in there," she said urgently. "He's going to kill them."
The guy shrugged at her.
"Suits me," he said. "Kill them all is what I say."
She stared at him blankly. Tony moved behind the desk and sorted through the bricks of money. He stacked them neatly and counted out loud, moving them from one end of the desk to the other.
$40,000. "So, where are the keys?"
the new guy asked. Tony rolled open the desk drawer.
"These are for the Benz."
He tossed them to the guy and went into his pocket for another bunch.
"And these are for the Tahoe. It's in the garage downstairs." "What about the BMW?
The guy asked.
"Still up in Pound Ridge,"
Hobie called across the room.
"Keys?"
the guy asked.
"In the house, I guess,"
Hobie said. "She didn't bring a pocketbook, and it doesn't look like she's concealing them about her person, does it?" The guy stared at Marilyn's dress and smiled an ugly smile, all lips and tongue.
"There's something in there, that's for damn sure, but it don't look like keys."
She looked at him in disgust. The design on his jacket said Moe's Motors. It was embroidered in red silk. Hobie walked across the room and stood directly behind her. He leaned forward and brought the hook around into her line of vision. She stared at it close up. She shuddered.
"Where are the keys?"
he asked.
"The BMW is mine," she said.
"Not anymore, it isn't."
He moved the hook closer. She could smell the metal and the leather.
"I could search her," the new guy called. "Maybe she's concealing them after all. I can think of a couple of interesting places to look."
She shuddered.
"Keys,"
Hobie said to her softly.
"Kitchen counter,"
she whispered back. Hobie took the hook away and walked around in front of her, smiling. The new guy looked disappointed. He nodded to confirm he'd heard the whisper and walked slowly to the door, jingling the Benz keys and the Tahoe keys in his hands.
"Pleasure doing business,"
he said as he walked. Then he paused at the door and looked back, straight at Marilyn.
"You completely sure that's off limits, Hobie? Seeing as how we're old friends and all? Done a lot of business together?"
Hobie shook his head like he meant it.
"Forget about it. This one's mine."
The guy shrugged and walked out of the office, swinging the keys. The door closed behind him, and they heard the second thump of the lobby door a moment later. Then there was elevator whine, and the office fell silent again. Hobie glanced at the stacks of dollar bills on the desk and headed back to the bathroom. Marilyn and Chester were kept side by side on the sofa, cold, sick, and hungry. The light coming in through the chinks in the blinds faded away to the yellow dullness of evening, and the silence from the bathroom continued until a point Marilyn guessed was around 8 o'clock in the evening. Then it was shattered by screaming. The plane chased the sun west, but lost time all the way, and arrived on Oahu 3 hours in arrears in the middle of the afternoon. The first-class cabin was emptied ahead of business class and coach, which meant Reacher and Jody were the first people outside the terminal and into the taxi line. The temperature and the humidity out there were similar to Texas, but the damp had a saline quality to it because of the Pacific close by. And the light was calmer. The jagged green mountains and the blue of the sea bathed the island with the jeweled glow of the tropics. Jody put her dark glasses on again and gazed beyond the airport fences with the mild curiosity of somebody who had passed through Hawaii 12 times in her father's service days without ever really stopping there. Reacher did the same. He had used it as a Pacific stepping stone more times than he could count, but he'd never served in Hawaii.